If you could see me in this radio studio right now, you'd see me holding a book. And if you flip through the pages of this book, you'd see Amy Schumer talking about her parents' divorce. You flip a couple more pages, and then there's Bruce Springsteen, how hard it is for him to trust people. Another couple of pages, you'll see Barack Obama talking about watching his kids grow up. That book is called Waiting for the Punch, and it's a collection of moments taken from the podcast WTF with Marc Maron. For 9 years now, Marc Maron has been putting out 2 episodes a week of his show. That's 2 hour or more in-depth conversations every single week. And when I say in-depth, he goes deep. This is a show where people talk about their struggles with mental health. They come out. They open up about painful family histories. It's also almost always really, really funny and kind of inspiring. You're about to hear Marc Maron talk about this book, Waiting for the Punch, and how it compiles moments from his interviews. And it's a book that he's written with his producer of WTF, Brendan McDonald. But right off the bat, he talked about revisiting his older interviews. I'm really excited to talk to you. In the book, you say you don't listen to your interviews after you record them. So I want to ask, what surprised you the most when you read these interviews on the page?
That I even had those conversations. I mean, when I'm engaged in a conversation, yeah, I'm engaged in it, and there are bits and pieces that I take away from it sometimes that change my life or are memorable or that made me laugh. But after you've had almost 900 conversations, they don't all stick. So having the opportunity to see these things sort of cut up and put into context of themes in the book and see how they flow together, I'm astounded at you know, the depth of a lot of the observations and the feelings and the conversations, but also just that, wow, sometimes when I read them, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember they said that. And other times I'm like, I don't remember this at all. This is amazing. I'm glad I had this conversation. I should go back, but there's only so many hours in the day, man.
I know, but it's sometimes when I have, like, caught my show in the nighttime and I'll kind of wince my way through it and want to turn it off.
Oh, so you don't like hearing yourself?
I guess I just hear, like, I'm a musician too. Like, I guess I just hear what I wish I had done.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. I mean, I get that with my stand-up sometimes. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about it once it's done. And obviously, I know sometimes I tend to interject myself too much. But I have to accept that stylistically, I am where I am at. And that it seems compelling and interesting to people. So I don't know that I need to change things. And I know the things that I have evolved over time in my ability to have a conversation. Over time, I have learned to listen better. I have learned to, not interject when, you know, out of habit or of discomfort. I've learned how to let silences sit a little bit. So I have learned things over time just from doing it. And understanding where I was at when I started and where I'm at now. But I don't need to study myself. And sometimes when I hear myself, I get a little uncomfortable, but not as much as I used to.
Is there anything that's harder for you now than when you first started doing interviews?
I mean, you don't want to drift into a pattern, and you want to remain interested. I don't think I have as many of the immediate problems I had when I started the podcast, and the urgency was certainly different. I mean, geez, man, we work awfully hard, and it is sort of a full-time job to do the podcast and to do the interviews and to manage it with Brendan. So when things do become a job, ultimately, you are feeding something, and some days you may not want to go to work, but I mean, the things that have changed for me is really just in conversation, I'm not as desperate and screwed up and in a bad place as I was for the first couple years of the show, and maybe even the first 3 or 4 years. I'm a little more comfortable. I'm able to have a little lighter conversation. I think I'm able to have a better time with them, but I also fear complacency. So, yeah, I make sure that I maintain just a little discomfort in my life and in my mind at all times. I try to avoid joy and sort of dodge happiness for any prolonged period. It's being made much easier given the political culture in our country right now. So that's been taken care of.
You mentioned for the first 3 or 4 years, you don't feel as screwed up, you don't feel as messed up as you once were. In the introduction to the book, you talk about how you started WTF out of complete desperation. And I think there was something appealing about that you were this underdog.
Yeah.
That you had something to prove. And then it becomes this huge podcast. You interview the president, Bruce Springsteen, a great Keith Richards episode. You're playing big venues when you do stand-up. You have Maron, you have Glow. But do you still feel like an underdog?
Well, no. I mean, I feel like a guy that it took a long time, maybe just the right amount of time for me to find some success in life. The way I came about my success, I would still feel is somewhat of an underdog story and just a matter of persistence and good cosmic timing, ultimately. And also I imagine there's a certain amount of skill and talent involved, but I do feel like my career path was one of an underdog in the sense that, I was 45 and it was not happening. Am I an underdog now? No, I don't think so, but I'm also at a level of popularity that is manageable and is not necessarily mainstream or even, I would still say that most people don't know who I am. And is that an underdog position? Not really. It's comfortable for me. It's a little weird when, three guys walk up to you and one dude's really excited and he's like, "Oh man, that's Marc Maron." And two of his friends are like, I don't know. I know nothing about that guy. I don't know who that is. and then me having to watch the one guy who knows me explain to his friends who I am and then still have them not know. That's not a big payoff, for the work I've put in.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm glad the one guy likes me.
Is there a bar you have in your head when you walk out of an interview back into your house from your garage? You say that went well. I did a good job.
Well, yeah, I know because I will talk to people for an hour. And if I can't get to an hour, then I realize, well, this is the range I'm dealing with here. And I think we've tapped it out. That doesn't happen very often. If I find that I'm having a hard time connecting, sometimes, I'll keep people in there an hour and a half, 2 hours. And they don't really know it, but I know it. But I'm looking for something that's going to hold the whole thing together.
Well, what is it that you're looking for?
Well, a lot of times people will, I don't mind being entertained and I don't mind if the conversation isn't about someone's life. It may be about if it's a career arc or whatever, that's fine. But a lot of times, some conversations will be relatively unanchored and it seems like at some point that we're just circling something. And sometimes you're just waiting for something to connect. I don't know what it is, but I know it when I feel it. And even if it's for a few minutes, that could be worth waiting an hour and a half for. And even the stuff leading up to it, I'm a little hard on myself and on the conversation sometimes. But a lot of times things don't happen until that last 15 minutes in terms of connection or getting somewhere with a story or something they're connected to or surprised that they're talking about. Sometimes it takes people a while to get comfortable. And sometimes people don't get comfortable. And then I get this other thing, I get a show of some kind. And if the show's good and I'm entertained and laughing and having fun with the person, I'm good with that,
You also talk in your book in the beginning about how it's harder for people to talk to each other these days.
Yeah, well, nobody really, it seems to be just too much for people. It's just so much easier and people have gotten so acclimated to not even emailing and certainly not talking on the phone, but it seems mostly, texting or direct messaging. And you really have to set time aside to have a real conversation with somebody. And I don't know if anyone really does that anymore on purpose.
But I think what you're talking about, there's a deeper humanity there, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, there is the emotional journey and, the sort of excitement on some level of human connection is real. I mean, we're social animals and we enjoy things like feeling acknowledged by each other, loving each other, understanding each other, helping each other. These are things that we innately want to do, actually. And I think even a fairly mundane conversation for an hour can be, especially in this day and age, incredibly powerful. I have them all the time where, you know, you get out of yourself, you engage with somebody else, you share thoughts, you share ideas, you're there for each other, even if you don't know each other that well. And you know, for that conversation, and all those things are very tangible. I mean, you can feel that stuff. And I think that for some reason, those feelings, even if they're good, have become burdensome to some people, or they make people uncomfortable. So the nature of trusting each other, even in a passive way, with even polite discourses, kind of fallen to the wayside because people are uncomfortable to reveal themselves and uncomfortable to sort of manage even a minor burden of, hey, could you hold that door for me? You know, there are two ways you can go with that, right? You know, it's like, of course I can, and it actually feels good to do it. Like, that's a sad indication that things have gotten pretty bad. It's like, hey, I held a door for somebody today, and, you know, it made me feel good about myself. It's like, wow, we've really drifted, you know? So,
yeah, I didn't push someone over today. I really feel good about myself.
So, you know, I think that, you know, I think it is just a matter of the pace and the detachment. I think everybody's, you know, kind of scared and kind of lonely and kind of angry and kind of unsatisfied and isolated. And I don't think that communicating through text does anything to help that. You know, everything's become sort of a kind of a dopamine rush that, you know, interactions, you know, don't have any emotional nuance to them. You're just sort of waiting for that text or waiting for that tweet or waiting for that email. And you're like, oh, there it is. Oh, what do they say? Even if it's a little one, you know, it's more about the reception and deliverance of bits and pieces of information than the actual kind of emotional connection and moving through someone else's personal narrative and feelings. It's diminished almost entirely.
I just got just two more questions for you, and you've been really generous with your time. I was thinking about your Netflix special the other day. I was thinking about Too Real. I want to play a clip. This comes from after you're talking about how divided America is.
But then I try to have a conversation with these people because I know them, and you know, I don't want this polarization. We've got at some point we're going to have to bridge it. You know, so I'm like, I don't get, try, just explain to me really why. I mean, how are we going to communicate now? And he's like, well, come on, man. You know, we're all Americans. And I'm like, no. Not enough. Not going to be enough. Well, come on. We, you know, like you know, everyone loves, you know, Tom Petty and burritos. Yeah, that's true. But I don't think Petty is enough to bridge this gap. I just don't think that he has that power at this juncture.
Did you think on that bit when you heard of Tom Petty's passing?
Yeah, a lot of people did. It's just terrible. It's just the timing of it's just terrible. I mean, you know, and I just, it's a tragedy. You know, that was a rough day, man.
Yeah.
The day before yesterday or whenever, you know, with all that horror and, you know, killing in Las Vegas, just, you know, that we have to, you know, integrate this, you know, that somehow, you know, that's part of the American experience is just, you know, whack jobs with, you know, arsenals. You know, it's, you know, something's got to change here around that stuff. But then on top of it, you know, Petty dies. It's just like, oh my God, it's very hard for me in this political climate, not to feel like something, you know, biblical or, you know, prophetic is happening in terms of just how insane it all is. And then when that guy dies, I just saw him too, like 2 weeks ago. And I saw the second to the last show of his last tour, as it turns out. And it was the first time I'd seen him. It was just great. And I just love the guy. And it's just heartbreaking. And it is heartbreaking for the reasons I said. I mean, obviously, we'll still have his music, you know, and we're losing a lot of that generation of artists. But you know, you like knowing these people are around because he was such a, you know, just a beautiful force in the world. And to see him live for the first time and he experienced that, you know, just a week or so before he died, it's just heartbreaking because he was one of the great things, one of the good things about America. And you know, we need as many of those as we can to stick around right now. There's not a lot of good news around.
Have you been noticing that, say, like, see, Jimmy Kimmel is now speaking out more politically than I think he's ever has. Stephen Colbert has been kind of doing a political show since he started his version of the Late Show. Jimmy Fallon is in some ways trying to recapture some political environment after, I think, you know, kind of blowing it with Donald Trump. I mean, that's just what I think. Do you see comedians, artists, late night hosts having a role at a time like this?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, they always have a role. You know, it's just a matter of how deep you want to go and how involved you want to be and whether it stays funny or whether it doesn't. You know, satire is a tricky thing in a world that is a farce. So, but they absolutely have a role, not unlike the press. There's very few checks and balances left in single party rule. So, you know, between the press and, you know, the kind of like hit or miss judicial system, you know, and comedians, what have you got to sort of stand up to this guy and to stand up to the people that support him when it comes to their incredibly demonic and evil, you know, positions on things. So yeah, it's important. I mean, I did political talk radio for a couple of years, and, you know, I got away from it, and I'm still, you know, I don't really want to be in the fray of punditry, but I think if you speak your heart, you're okay. I think that's what Jimmy's doing. I think that Jimmy Kimmel is speaking his heart. I think that, you know, Stephen Colbert is also speaking his heart, but is a very structured satirical position he's taking, you know, as is, you know, many of the other comics. But, you know, the interesting thing about Kimmel is stepping out of the role of comedian and entertainer to speak his heart and to make an appeal for common sense in the face of horror and in the face of inhumanity, legislative inhumanity and criminal inhumanity. So, you know, I think that's a human position to take. That's, you know, not a comedic position, though. If you can make that funny, that's great.
But it's almost more meaningful because he hasn't been like entirely coming at things from a politically satirical role up to this point.
Right. You know, well, there's people that just do jokes, you know, that are on the surface. And then there's people that go deeper, you know, with intellect and with feeling. And I think Colbert does a good job, you know, crafting, you know, jokes that are, you know, kind of hard hitting. And, you know, his heart is definitely in the right place. So he does a combination of that. But I don't think that was Jimmy's nature, Kimmel. And I think that this stuff has really struck him, you know, as an American and as somebody who, you know, has some amount of, you know, illness in his life. And then, you know, the fact that he grew up in Las Vegas, that this stuff is really hitting him in a human way. And he felt it necessary. And it's more powerful for somebody like him or any of us to step out of the role of clown or entertainer to say, what are we doing?
Right.
You know, what is happening? I'm very proud of him, and I'm, you know, it's very impressive and necessary that he does that.
I bring up Jimmy Fallon too about ruffling Donald Trump's hair, and it made me think about that. You had interviewed Barack Obama, the president of the United States. Have you ever given any thought to if Donald Trump's people called you up and said if he wanted to come on the show, do you think he'd do it?
Well, yeah, I mean, Brendan and I have talked about it, and if we, you know, our feeling is that if he would abide by the same conditions as President Obama, which was, you know, they did not vet questions. You know, we got final edit, and that was that.
Do you think about what you'd ask him?
Well, that he'd be tricky. I mean, having grown up with, you know, a narcissistic parent, the public face is also the face of a pathological problem. Mental problem. You know, he has a mental problem. And, you know, that's tricky because, you know, what's underneath the sort of facade of narcissism is pretty scary stuff. It's pretty nihilistic. It's pretty lonely and empty. There's a vacuum there. So I'd kind of like to get to that place, but I don't know if I could or what would happen if I did.
Mark, thanks for talking to me today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Good talking to you.
All right, man. Take care.
You too.
It's funny, you know, at the beginning of the interview, I don't know if you caught it, but he said, it's sometimes really, really hard to listen back to your own interviews. He just doesn't do it. And I said, I really don't love doing it either because it kind of makes me cringe the way I try to do it. And I sat in the studio, we taped that yesterday, I sat in a radio studio and listened to that go out just then. And sometimes what you hear is yourself realizing in an interview how much someone means to you. And I listen to a lot of that podcast, and I guess I do relatively similar work, though in a kind of a different format than he does. And I think I could just hear my own excitement there. And I cringed, but I really hope you enjoyed it. That's Marc Maron. He's a comedian and a podcaster. His new book that he's written with WTF producer Brendan McDonald is called Waiting for the Punch. It's out October 10th.